This is World Radio, KHOE, 90.5 FM on your dial. And this is the program, A Chat with the Dean, with your host, Dean Kathy Guarini, Dean of Faculty here at Maharshi University of Management. And today she will be hosting Stephen Burney, author of The Best of All Worlds, a book that has captured the imagination of many of us here at MUM in Fairfield. And Kathy, we have talked on your program with authors before, Dr. Greeny, but wouldn't you say that this one has a completely unique approach and flavor?
Yes, this is very interesting. Steve's book, The Best of All Possible Worlds, is a novel, and we've talked about scientific research, we've talked about scholarly publications, and all kinds of things like that, but as far as I know, this is really the first what I would call movement novel, somebody talking about experiences as a meditator, as a TM teacher, in a novel, which I think is fascinating. Now, I do want to find out more about you, Steve, but how did you come up with the idea of writing a novel that included TM and TM experiences?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on the show. I'm very happy to be here with you today. I think the idea of writing a book was with me for a long time, but the actual seed that really sort of got it going, or the impulse, was around 2004. I was invited to attend my son's world religions class at Northfield Mount Hermon School, which is a private preparatory school, and the teacher there knew that I was a TM teacher from discussing it with Michael, my son. And he invited me to come up to talk about the Vedas and transcendental meditation. So I was happy to do that. And when I got to the school there in the class, there was about 15 students, sophomores and juniors, from different countries. And so it was a pretty sophisticated group, I thought. And the surprising thing was that after I got done speaking, it came out in the discussion that actually nobody in that class had heard of TM or of Maharishi. And that really set me back a bit. And so on the way home from school that day, I was driving with Michael, and I mentioned to him that, gee, you know, maybe I should write a book, Michael, to discuss Maharishi and TM and the knowledge. And I could do it in the form of a story, which might be easier for a lot of people. And it could be something that they might remember more. And my son gave a very surprising but sophisticated answer, I thought. He said, well, Dad, I think that Maharishi has to get into the literature. Otherwise, over time, he could be forgotten. And I know that sounds very extreme, you know, when you're living in Fairfield, Iowa, but there was evidence of this happening in the world already, and so that got me thinking about writing it. And then I think secondly, being a father of two sons, I wanted to share with them my experiences, you know, being 19 years old and starting transcendental meditation and being so enthralled with it that I quit school, left college to become a TM teacher. And I wanted to, you know, have that, I wanted to put it down in a book form. They've heard lots of stories from my wife and I, who's also Kay, who's also a TM teacher, but I wanted to put it down in a book so that they would have it. So between those two impulses, I started writing it in 2006.
So you said that you wanted them to know about when you started transcendental meditation at age 19. Could you tell us about that, how that happened?
Yeah, sure. I was a student at Plymouth State College at the time and had a wonderful professor there named Dr. David Haight, who was a philosophy professor and had started TM 2 years earlier. And he discussed Marshy in some of his classes, which I was in, and I used to go after class sometimes to see him in his office, and we continued discussing TM, and I got very, very interested in my spring break in April of 1974. I went down to the Cambridge TM Center and was initiated. It was such an exciting time for me, as well as a lot of people, but in my mind at that time, we were really discussing in philosophy this idea of the full potential school, and that there were ways to maximize one's full potential. And I remember just feeling so excited that I'd learned TM and was meditating that I was literally running from building to building in between classes because I was just, so happy and excited about what I was doing. So that's how I started TM. And then at one point I realized that I wanted to learn more, and my parents were a little bit upset, but I actually left school, left Plymouth, and I moved to Amherst, Massachusetts, so I could be near a TM center and take the Science of Creative Intelligence course, which I did, and then that led me to wanting to apply to teacher training. So I attended teacher training phase one in September of 1975, and at Livingston Manor, and I was fortunate enough that Marshy came to Livingston Manor twice that year during my course. So that was wonderful.
And then you came to MUM, MIU then? When was
that?
Well,
actually, I finished teacher training in Avoriaz, France in July of 1976. And then I did teach TM for a while in Amherst in New Hampshire. And then I ended up coming to Fairfield first to the Capitol for governor training. I did a four-month governor training course. I was in one of the frats out in the, on campus.
And when was that?
That was in, that started in December of 77 and finished up in April of 78. So by that time, I really felt that I wanted to go back and finish school, and MUM was the only place I could possibly go to. So I arrived back on campus in August of 1978 and was, took the core courses, which were fantastic, and then did two more years in the philosophy major and graduated in 1981. With a degree in philosophy.
And then what did you do?
Well,
I realize there's not too many philosophers.
Then I fell in love with Kay Noble. Actually, before I graduated, I did. And she was working in the MIU press at the time. And then I decided to go into business because I had some college loans to pay off. And I also had a feeling that I would be getting married and wanting to have a family. So that was all lining up in my mind. So Kay and I spent the next 25 years in three different businesses. We were in the Oriental Import business for a while, and then we moved on to having a restaurant, and then eventually we opened a wholesale bakery. So in 2005... I was able to sell the bakery and, sort of go into a state of semi-retirement. Mm-hmm. And that's when I had the opportunity to start working on this book.
And in those businesses, did you find that your training as a philosophy major or your training as a governor of the Age of Enlightenment or your meditation practice, did any of those help in any way?
Oh, yes, tremendously. I was very creative in my businesses, and in each business I, got accolades from many, many hundreds of people for, doing such a good job in either, creating the business or in the quality of the food. Our restaurant was a small restaurant, but we had waiting lines all day Saturday and Sunday to actually get in. And I was actually able to teach number of my employees Transcendental Meditation while I had the restaurant. And later, the bakery, which we had for 11 years, we produced an all-natural tea bread, 10 different flavors. And, you know, I was able to do that fairly easily. And I think, you know, the quality of awareness that long-term meditators have, you know, makes challenges relatively easy. I think if people just take the time to think about it and, you know, really envision what they want to create, it happens pretty easily. And it did so in my case.
That's amazing. Now, I don't really want to talk too much about the book because I don't want to give anything away for people. I do want to have you read something from the book a little later. But could you tell us about the writing process? You know, writing a novel, you know, being in business, I don't think you had many opportunities to write.
No, I didn't have any.
How did it all start?
Well, in business, I only got to write business letters. I was pretty good at that. I love to read, and, you know, at one point, we had just moved recently from our main house, and in our house, I think we had over 1,500 books. You know, that was, you know, probably, you know, 30 years of collecting books, but all of us are readers. So I think reading, if you want to be a writer, I think reading is a very, very good place to start. But my process of writing was interesting, and I think it has to deal with, you know, the practice of the TM Cities program. And I'll explain that, why I mean that, or what I mean by that. But, you know, I found that when I was traveling around for my bakery business the last couple of years, I noticed that when I was driving along, you know, my mind would be very, very, very quiet. And then I would have some thought would come up, and, you know, that thought would lead me to lots of other thoughts. Reminded me a little bit about David Lynch's Catching the Big Fish. But when I was thinking about this book, I was thinking about it not on a real conscious level, on some other level of my mind, and the phrase, the best of all possible worlds, just started bubbling up into my awareness. And I didn't really put too much attention on it. I just would have it and kind of let it go, and then, you know, it would come back. And so what happened for me was that phrase, the best of all possible worlds, which is something that Leibniz, philosopher, in 18th century, he had, you know, made a whole argument for that this was the best of all possible worlds. And I had taken a course in Leibniz back in 74. Mm-hmm. It was funny to me that was coming up. But then I just began to realize that could be a jumping off point, you know, for this novel that I wanted to create. And so the first line that I wrote in the novel was Julian Driscoll thought about Leibniz. And so it went from there. My writing process was not a process that I sat down every day and wrote 4 pages. Mine was more like I would be thinking for a couple of weeks, and then I would sit down and I would write the whole chapter in a couple of hours. And then I would just let that sit for a while, and then I would just begin thinking about what would happen next in this story. And usually I would have the title of the chapter come, or the first sentence or something come, and I sort of got a signal that I was ready to sort of sit down and write again. And so I would sit down and I would write the next chapter in one sitting. And the whole thing proceeded like that. So I think it was partly due, you know, to the training that we've all had, and that's just the way my mind seems to work now.
That's really amazing, because writing is such a process of distilling ideas and integrating and everything, and to have it done that way in your awareness and then just write it out is really quite amazing. Would this be a good time to read these selections? Do you have some selections you could
read
for us?
Well, I have two selections, and so let me just find my book.
And you can tell us a little bit about where they are and why they are, but don't give the story away.
Right, okay. Well, I wanted to, you know, the first selection I have is really just to kind of give the listeners an idea of the tone of the book, because it certainly is a book about transcendental meditation, but it also, I tried to create a story that had quite a number of characters and that were interesting, that the story itself was sort of compelling. And so this section I want to read just talks about the main character, who comes from New York City, is born and raised in New York City, and is a Irish Catholic. And I think this chapter sort of reflects a little bit about the sort of the attitude of Irish Catholics in that era. So let me just start with that. So Sam loved walking into the cafe and seeing his parents behind the counter, absorbed in their work. He would walk up to where they were standing and, with a disguised voice, complain, "Can't a person get any service around here?" His father would consistently react, ready for a verbal battle. His mother always knew it was him. When all eyes met, smiles and shouts of joy would erupt, along with greetings all around and a few "God bless yous" to boot. Coffee would be poured, pastries selected, and Maria called from the back to stand at the cash register while the three of them slipped off to a corner booth. Lily, Sam's mother, would catch Sam up on the home front, and Jimmy, his father, on the business, the mayor, the president, who, by the way, according to Jimmy, was a lying, no-good son of a gun. Lily, at that point, would remind her husband that it was always best to forgive and forget, to which Jimmy replied, "When this president is out of office and gone, maybe." Sam would marvel at his parents' capacity for news and controversy. Behind that was a constant love that shone in their eyes, a love that they couldn't conceal from anyone. On this particular day, Sam revealed that he had met someone special that quieted both parents down. "I'm in love," Sam confessed. "She's beautiful, intelligent, kind, and spiritual." "And she's Catholic?" they asked in unison. No, but she's wonderful." Jimmy and Lily wanted Catholic grandchildren baptized and confirmed. "So she wouldn't mind converting and being married in the church," Lily said with a smile. "I don't know. I didn't ask. Besides, we just met. We've only had two dates." Jimmy and Lily were immediately relieved. "Oh, you just met," said Jimmy. "Oh, that's different. Why didn't you say so in the first place, son? Your poor mother is all upset and excited. Now, Lily, calm yourself, dear. They only just met," Jimmy counseled. "Jimmy, my dearest, I'm sitting right here and can hear with my own ears what my own darling son has been saying," Lily stated calmly and slowly. "Thank you very much, just the same." "Oh, well, if you're going to be that way about it, I'll just sit here and not try to help you calm yourself in any way," Jimmy countered, turning slightly away. Lily looked to heaven and briefly mumbled a prayer for strength and patience. "Ah, James Patrick O'Connor, you are so gallant to come to my rescue," she announced, and then she gave her husband a quick peck on his ruddy cheek, which cheered Jimmy considerably. Sam looked on in amusement and admiration, along with a bit of horror. He thought, "the Catholic question rears its head for the umpteenth time." "So where is this young woman now?" inquired Lily. "Oh, I'd say she's getting ready to land in Geneva any moment." "Geneva? Like the convention? Like in Switzerland?" Jimmy piped in. "Yes, like in Switzerland," Sam said. "Oh, she's the mountaineering outdoors type," his dad offered. "No," said Sam, "she's the meditating spiritual type who's searching for enlightenment." "Oh," acknowledged his parents, not really knowing what type that was. So for me, you know, I them, you know, began meditation over the years, including my nieces and nephews. And I should just say that two of my sisters, Kim and Carrie, were also at MIU while I was there as a student.
Uh-huh, yes, I remember them.
So I wanted to make the story of just a full story, and I think that's, you know, very refreshing. And the trick for me was to do that, but also to weave in Maharshi's knowledge, and so that the reader really got some benefit from reading it.
Yeah. Well, that passage definitely captured the feeling of trying to explain to parents meditation. I mean, you're not explaining meditation, but just this whole new shift, because we all went through it. You know, explain, well, some people, their parents got them into meditation, but for most of us, we learned TM and then had to find a way to bring up the idea of meditation, spirituality, going off to Switzerland, because in those days people didn't travel nearly as much as they do today. So I think you really captured that, and in following chapters, of course, there was much more on that, bringing a traditional ordinary American family into understanding of Maharshi's knowledge. So you wanted to read, there was another passage?
Well, there's another passage a little later on where Sam has met Julian, who is a character in the book that comes in later, and it gives Sam an opportunity to sit with a student. Julian is a student at Amherst College, where actually Sam had gone to school, and he's a philosophy major. And Sam has been out of teaching for a while, but has this sort of chance encounter with Julian. And Julian and Katie begin transcendental meditation, and then this is a meeting at this cafe. I'll just read a short passage, and this is, you know, basically after they have taken their TM course, and now they're just meeting and, you know, over a cup of coffee, talking at the cafe. This is a little hard to just sort of pick a couple of paragraphs, but I'm gonna give this a whirl and see how this works. So Sam is speaking, and he says, "You and Katie are growing towards the fifth state of consciousness, cosmic consciousness, that we discussed during your TM course. Remember that eventually we come to a point where we never lose pure consciousness or infinite inner wakefulness. We have it during sleep, dreaming, and even life's, and even under life's most demanding circumstances." Just stop for a second, Stan. "Each time we alternate the experience of pure consciousness while meditating with whatever we do during the day, we permanently stabilize our ability to engage in life with greater and greater values of consciousness. The stabilization or integration of pure consciousness grows automatically. That level of silent awareness becomes more and more present until it never goes away. Maharshi describes it as a perfectly natural process as long as we continue to dip into pure consciousness every day, twice a day, and don't regularly exhaust ourselves. It sounds pretty fantastic, almost too simple for what it is," said Julian. "So this would be the goal of meditation, to know who you are?" Sam, strictly speaking, there are no goals. When seekers create goals, they try to define the indefinable. They remain in the realm of beliefs and concepts, and the transcendent is something that we can only be. We cannot know it intellectually, we can become it. In truth, we already are that infinite being, only just about everyone has forgotten. That's why we call it a pathless path. We already are infinite and perfect. We already are what we are seeking." Julian, "That's all fine, Sam, but as I see it, we're all disconnected and filled with insecurity." "Well, Julian, I think you're catching on. Remember that the world looks different in different states of consciousness. When we don't experience our true unbounded nature, we are left with the limitations of waking, dreaming, and deep sleep. When we step into life with limited awareness, we are easily overshadowed by whatever life sends us. Our mood, our level of fulfillment, goes up and down with life's tides. We could say that life sometimes seems to kick us around like a football. This feeling good one moment and lousy the next creates seekers out of all of us. The ups and downs grow exhausting, discouraging, even depressing, and we start seeking lasting fulfillment. Fortunately, Maharishi has revived the knowledge and the techniques that allow us to live full, unlimited potential. Suddenly, a new awareness, a new sense of life's possibilities is created. That new awareness creates a new point of view, and the world shifts. When we learn TM and start to transcend, the world again shifts quietly. Sam paused a moment before he continued. Did you know, for instance, that it wasn't very long ago that people thought it was impossible to break a four-minute mile? No runner could do it. Why do you think that was? Julian. Because they thought it was impossible. Right. But it wasn't physically impossible. It was a point of view that everyone shared. So along comes Roger Bannister. He changed his point of view and set out to show the world that a runner could break the four-minute mile. And he did it. And once he did it, other runners could do it. Once a new awareness is created, everyone can share in it. It's a breakthrough. This is what I mean when I say awareness shifts. It happens to individuals and to whole societies. As awareness grows, understanding grows with it. Points of view change. What was impossible one moment becomes possible the next. Old beliefs are discarded and new ones replace them. When people realize that they haven't come even close to tapping their true potential, and it's possible to do so, a tremendous shift will happen and the world will change. What we're calling enlightenment, a state of fully realized potential, will be seen as the new norm. Once that happens, it's a whole new ball game. So that's the kind of excitement that I felt in 1974, 75, and really to the present moment, that what Maharishi has done is something that's just, utterly incredible, that as a single individual coming out of India, that his impact on the world has been so transformative, and that the world at some point will catch on, and that cosmic consciousness will become the norm, and the world will be a completely different place.
This is the show, A Chat with the Dean. We have today Stephen Verney talking about his book, The Best of All Possible Worlds, his novel that just recently came out. My name is Kathy Guarini. I'm the Dean of Faculty at MUM, and you're listening to KHOE 90.5 FM.
Very good.
So, is he going to say that sentence again?
Okay. So, the excitement that I felt in writing the book was the excitement that last reading embodied, in that, that Maharishi, as this individual, the single individual coming out of India, was able to bring these techniques and knowledge to the world, and that all of us, are the beneficiaries of this. And I wanted to write the book in such a way that so when people finished reading the book, that they just felt and understood that transcending is a very natural and effortless process, and that TM is the technique to do that, and also that the growth of higher states of consciousness, the growth of someone realizing, actualizing their full potential, was also natural and effortless. And so that's the spirit of the book, and that's how I've been feeling, since 1974.
And what I really enjoyed was how naturally you integrated Maharishi's knowledge into the dramatic events of these people's lives, and how you also unfolded the knowledge very, very sequentially, so that it just seemed very natural what was being discussed by the characters, but when you look at the book as a whole, the progression of knowledge was there. So I really enjoyed that. Now, I have a question about this, and I know you don't want to give too many details away, but the poetry of Walt Whitman plays an important part toward the end of the book. How did you get interested in Walt Whitman, and what inspired you to use his poetry in the framework of the book?
That's a great question. Well, when I first started TM, I was just really looking for anything that I could read, either on transcendental meditation, of course, including The Science of Being and the Maharishi's commentary in the Bhagavad Gita, but also just anything that was, you know, in that direction. And I remember a friend of mine at the time mentioned to me that he thought that Walt Whitman was enlightened. And so that's all it took for me, you know, to go out and buy leaves of grass, because I was just so hungry looking for that kind of verification. And, it just thrilled me. So I began reading Walt Whitman in 1975, and I just read him like the character in the book. You know, I read him daily for many, many years, and as I was reading him more and more, I just began to see in Whitman not only his great genius, but his experiences of higher states of consciousness. And in writing this book, I wanted to show, not only through the character of Sam O'Connor, who's the main character, and his wife Amy, but also in Western literature and Western philosophy, that you know, enlightenment, the higher states of consciousness, that has also been a part of our Western tradition. Although, you know, the Eastern tradition, Maharishi's Vedic tradition, makes the whole thing so crystal clear. But that, you know, enlightenment is a universal experience, and that there have been people in the West that have also had enlightened experiences and talked about enlightenment. So I thought that this would give me a platform to discuss those ideas and to share some of those insights.
And you did a beautiful job of that. Now I'm interested, you know, the nature of life is to grow. You've got this book. Oh, actually, before I ask what's next, I want to know, what has been the response? I know you have there's a quote on the cover from David Lynch, which is really quite amazing, and several reviews on the back cover. Could you tell us a little bit about the process of publishing the book itself and how these people came to read it and give you feedback?
Sure. In publishing the book, I really very much a novice in, you know, I mean, this is my first novel. I really didn't know how to go about publishing. It looked like to me, if I went the traditional route of, you know, sending out letters to agents or publishers, that it could take several years for this book to be published. And so after spending almost 6 years writing it, I really didn't want to wait another couple of years. So I went to what is called either self-publishing, or now it's talked about as publishing on demand, and I picked a publishing on demand company, which basically means that they create the book, and when someone orders it, that the book is just printed and shipped on demand. So there's not a large inventory. I didn't have to buy thousands of copies of the book and have it in my garage someplace. So that seemed to me to be the most efficient way. In the process of doing that, I had befriended Jerry Jarvis when I was at MIU. I just mentioned briefly that when I was at MIU my last year, I was elected student body president, and that gave me access to different people on campus. I had a weekly meeting with Lenny Goldman. I met quite frequently with Walter Koch at the time, and also that was the year that Jerry Jarvis was on campus, and so I got to speak to Jerry on a number of occasions. In any case, the last chapter, which is the lecture, the last chapter is the lecture, and I wrote that actually in two sittings. So I couldn't do that in one sitting. It's rather long, but I wrote it in two sittings, and it involves some of the history of the early TM movement. And so I sent that chapter to Jerry, for him to look it over to make sure that I had things correct. And I'm glad that I did, because he did correct a few small things. But more importantly, he got intrigued, by the nature of the book, and then asked me if I would send him the whole manuscript, which I did, and then he read. So he thought it was a really beautiful book, and it was really wonderful to have him call me and talk about the book with me. So then Jerry actually suggested, when I had it printed, that I should send a copy to David Lynch, and which I did with a cover letter. And I really didn't expect to really hear from David. I thought it was kind of a long shot, actually. But within a month, I had gotten this kind of interesting thing. This someone from Facebook had sent a friend request, and I didn't know who it was, but I responded. And the next thing I knew, I had a message from this particular person who lived in Los Angeles saying that he worked with David Lynch, and that David was trying to get in touch with me but didn't know how to get in touch with me. So the cover letter that I sent had been misplaced. So I responded by sending out my email address, and within maybe the next night or within that day, I had this beautiful email from David that he had read the book, and he said that I read your book and I loved it, and was basically saying it was, this is a very difficult subject, and you did it very, very beautifully, and we want to congratulate you. So that, you can imagine that was like, one of the first copies I'd sent out, and to get that kind of response, it was really amazing. And I also realized, how kind David Lynch is, to have taken the time to even read something by a first-time author, and then to send me an email. So later, when I was going to have the book printed for the second time, I asked David for a quote for the cover, and that's what he sent me. And I'll just read you the quote, because I think it does capture the book really quite well. So the quote is, "This book captures the thrill and magic of the spiritual path and how things make more and more sense the bigger the picture gets." David Lynch, filmmaker. So that's one level of response, which I thought was really fantastic. And on another level, I have heard that there are three new meditators in the world because they have read my book.
Wow, that's fabulous.
That was really exciting, and one of the persons is a woman from Lincoln, Nebraska, and she read the book, and she just absolutely loved it and contacted me to say how much she enjoyed it, and told me that she was going to be learning Transcendental Meditation, and that happened several months ago. And now I just heard from her recently that her husband and a group of friends are attending. I just attended an intro lecture in Lincoln, Nebraska, and so it looks like they're going to be starting as well. So that's another level, and that's what I was really hoping for, that that the book would get out into the world, and people would enjoy it and start TM. So that's another level.
That really, really is amazing. Do you know how she happened to find the book and read it?
Well, it's a funny thing, but I met her and we talked for, I was visiting in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and she was visiting at the same time, and we just happened to meet, and we spent about 10 or 15 minutes talking, and I just reached into my bag and handed her the book.
Wow. That's really amazing.
And then I heard from her sometime later. So it was one of those things. It was I just had a sense that I knew she'd be interested in it, and so that worked out very nicely. And the other person that I know of is from my hometown of my adopted hometown of New Salem, and so a woman there took the book out of the library, which I donated a copy, and she learned in the Greenfield, Massachusetts center. And then a third one is a young man who's actually a friend of. I'm very good friends with his mother, and she gave him the book for Christmas, and he since has started TM. So these are encouraging signs.
Boy, I'll say, because you know, when people are ready, they need the right information in order to get them. So it's just fascinating that they read it and could see that it was the right information that they needed.
Right. They all felt inspired by it. So that was very heartening. You know, because I think it's inspiring, but you know, I don't really count. So my vote doesn't count. It has to, you know, it has to see what other people feel, you know.
And anyone who reads it, who lived through those times,
right,
it really does bring back the thrill of going to Switzerland for the first time and seeing Maharshi
right.
for the first time and
yeah.
then coming back to the U.S. and initiating and seeing the change in people and
right.
And some of the reactions. And I got one thing, you know, as dean of faculty, I also meet other deans, and I got a big kick out of the one dean who was a meditator but wouldn't tell people.
Right.
I just felt like you captured all the different kinds of meditators we've seen over the years.
Right. And I think that is a crucial, I thought that was crucial to have that in there somehow, that, you know, for him it was a private. It was private, you know. He enjoyed it, and his wife and daughter enjoyed it, but it was sort of a private thing, yeah.
And we've all met people like that, and I'm always like, well, why don't you just tell people? But really and truly, some people,
yeah.
you know, that's just the way they want to be. They don't, you know, because I remember when I went to teacher training. At that point, I hadn't told that many people. It, you know, it just hadn't come up that I was a meditator. And then I realized, gee, if I go to teacher training and become a TM teacher, that's going to define me, define who I am to other people. And whereas before, you know, I was a mathematician, graduate student kind of person, and only a few people knew I was meditating. But then the more I thought about it, I thought, well, gee, that really is what I want, you know.
Right.
That is a better, higher calling.
Nothing. Right, something shifts, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. I agree.
And so, you know, what is next?
Well, let me just comment one more on,
yeah, yeah.
on the
uh-huh.
book, because the
yeah,
other
yeah.
thing that's been very interesting is I've had teachers and governors who have contacted me about the book, that they've just felt so moved by it, and they felt as if I had written their story. And I actually have had two governors that just asked me if they could come visit me at my house to sit and talk. So I didn't know of them beforehand. I'd never met them, so
yeah.
I agreed, you know. And so there's been kind of it's been a very interesting response for some people. It's been a very emotional response. It's sort of like, gee, you know, you told my story better than I could tell it, and I'm just so happy that to have it, you know, and. So there's been a lot of satisfaction and fulfillment for me. I mean, first of all, my two sons, you know, loved the book, and that was of course really key. My one son took the time to he said, "I marked the whole book up, you know, Dad, so that when I in the future when I want to sort of think about, what would Dad think about this? He said, I can go to the book. And I'll know exactly how you would feel. So that he thought it was, they both thought it was a very precious gift that I gave to them. So on that level, that was very, very fulfilling. But then to have people contact me out of the blue and just say, what a great book. I had never met George Ellis, for example, and he's the author, a new author also, with his book, Symphony of Silence. And he contacted me. He said, I read your book in 2.5 days. And I was just loved it, and we had a long hour-long discussion. And he called me out of the blue, basically. So it was so that's been fun. It's been fun in that way.
Yeah, we really are a family, and we've shared so many of the same experiences—not necessarily together, but in different parts of the world. That
right.
When somebody expresses them, it's just so easy to connect. That's really, really beautiful.
Thank you. Yeah, and
are you doing anything to promote the book now?
Well, I'm. I really should be doing more, honestly. But I have done a number of readings, and I'm on Facebook, and I have a Facebook page called The Best of All Possible Worlds. Mm-hmm. I also have a website called Steve Verney. Website is steveverney.com. That has some things about the book, and I continue to try to write things about the book to promote it. But it's I find promoting is a little bit difficult. I'm not, even though I was in business, I had to promote my business. I find it a little bit difficult, to promote it. So I've had help. Ken Chalkins at MIU or MUM has been really fantastic in helping me with some ideas, and a few other friends have also helped sort of get me out there with the book. So I really could do better on that, honestly, Kathy.
Yeah, well, I think the key really is to just get people to read it.
Yes, that is the key. And I think, I think this radio show will help, and I mean, everything that I've done in promoting it, it's all helped. So, and I'm, I think at a certain point, I hope that there'll be enough word of mouth and enough momentum, begins to happen where the book will just kind of have its own life and the book will find its way into many, many people's hands.
Yeah, I know it's being promoted on the TM.org website.
Yes, it has, yes.
That's nice.
Yes. Yeah, I was, I think I sent this to you, but I was happy to see that that the TM, I think it's TM.home website, recently made a list of the 10 best books on TM, and my book was named number 6, and I thought that was really fantastic, so I was very, very pleased.
Yeah, because it is a novel, after all, and so to give out this much knowledge in a novel is really quite,
when we were going through it, actually, we actually cut out a couple of chapters because she started saying there's just too much philosophy in this, there's a few chapters that didn't make it into it, because the thrill for me was to really to weave Maharishi's knowledge in it in a conversational way, with Sam and Julian, basically, sitting at this cafe. When I was a philosophy major, I took John Shear's course, Plato. And, of course, Plato, the dialogues of Plato is that whole, he creates this character, Socrates wasn't a character, but he put Socrates, his teacher, and he creates other people, and then they have this dialogue back and forth. And everything that Plato wrote was really along those lines. It wasn't, like an essay. It was really a dialogue with people talking. And I loved that. And so I wanted to try my hand at that, because I think, that exchange of ideas with two people sitting and talking, it does enable things to come out in a very natural and easy way.
Yeah, and it's a very effective way of introducing questions and alternate points of view.
Right.
And going deeper.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Well, I hope you find a way to work those lost chapters, so to speak, into some other book somehow.
Right, yes. Well, I am working on another book, and it's the same. It sort of started out the same way that this one did. I was kind of driving down from Amherst to Cape Cod, and this phrase popped into my mind, the llama that got away. And I thought, wow, that's a really interesting, you know, that's very interesting. And so, you know, I kind of let my mind sort of rest on that a little bit. And sure enough, you know, I started getting this idea for another story. And so I am working on that and sort of thinking about that. And I'm hoping not to take 5 or 6 years to write that one, maybe another year and a half. But it will be something similar in the sense that the hero of the book is going to be a philosophy professor, which is unusual these days. we don't have professors being heroes, but
we should have more of that, actually. So
yeah, I think we really should. You know, it's time for the. As I was saying to my son Michael about that, it's time for you know, men and women of knowledge to be sitting at the table, you know, again, and the head of the room. You know, because knowledge is the key. You know, action is great, and it can be sort of thrilling to watch and all. But really, you know, knowledge is the key. And so, you know, this story will evolve around again a professor and a student, but in a very, very different way than this book is. And you know, I'll try to bring out, you know, the knowledge of consciousness and evolution in a little different angle.
And will the locale be Massachusetts again, primarily?
It's actually going to be in Plymouth, New Hampshire.
Uh-huh.
Plymouth, New Hampshire. I'm going to use Plymouth State College as sort of the background of this next book, and I think it's going to be quite interesting. So.
Well, you know, it's interesting when you were talking about having a professor as the protagonist of a novel. I was thinking, gee, you know, do you see many books like that? And you know, there are people involved in knowledge and scientists and things like that in novels, but the knowledge that they have is usually not part of the novel, is not part of the story. And, I can think of many. There's no point in even bringing them out, but they go into their personal trials and tribulations, but not the knowledge. And
Right. That's
something very different about Maharshi's knowledge, is it's so interesting it can be a part of a novel.
Yeah, and I think it can be challenging to do it, but in my case, I just took a kind of an easy angle of really conversational, you know, a conversational angle. And so, you know, all of us are so well acquainted with the knowledge, and I'm sure there are people at MUM that have far more knowledge than I do, but, you know, for my purposes, you know, I wanted to write a book that, you know, meditators and governors could enjoy, but also people who hadn't started meditating yet, so I had to sort of strike a balance in that way, but for me, having a conversation and talking about knowledge, it was relatively easy to do. But I had to sort of find that angle so that it would all come out in a very natural and flowing way.
Well, thank you very much. I feel like that even today the knowledge has come out in a very natural and flowing way. And you've answered a lot of the questions that I had when I was reading the book, because I really had wanted to know more about how it all came about. And it's been a pleasure talking to you this afternoon.
Thank you so, thank you so much, Kim.
And I'm also looking forward to this next book. I think that'll be fun, too.
Yeah, that will be fun. I can promise you that. And anyway, I'd like to just say, Jay Gurudev, and thank you very much for having me on the show. And I'm glad that you enjoyed the book.
Thank you.
The other thing I didn't mention, and I don't know, it's probably too late at this point, but I also wanted just to mention that I, you know, the proceeds of the novel, half the proceeds of the novel, I'm donating to the David Lynch Foundation to support the work that the foundation is doing in bringing TM to, you know, children, underprivileged, at-risk children all over the world. I think it's really incredible. And so I don't know if you know much about publishing, but you don't actually make too much on books. But I think I might in, might make maybe $2 a copy if it's sold, you know, by Amazon or something. So, so anyway, but my goal in all of this was I really would like to at least sell 100,000 copies and therefore be able to, you know, give a check to the Lynch, David Lynch Foundation for $100,000.
Oh, good. That's a good goal. And your association with the David Lynch Foundation might come in handy. You know, they're filmmakers, you know.
Right. Well, I haven't approached anybody about that yet, but that George Ellis, when he wrote a review for Amazon, he said at the very end of the review that, you know, this book is so beautiful, somebody's got to make a movie out of it. And I thought, well, that's a great thought. That would be, that's really worthwhile. So, and I think this, you know, when I thought about it, I think this could really be made into a movie. It's got, you know, beautiful locations and, you know, there's a compelling story.
Right.
And there's a great ending.
And we hope the lecture doesn't get cut. We want the knowledge in there.
I know. You know, that lecture, I'll just tell you, I spent 3 months thinking about that chapter before I wrote it, and I wrote the first part. I think I spent about 3 hours typing away and then went to bed. And I actually had a dream about Walt Whitman and I taking a walk in the woods. So then when I, you know, the next night I wrote the second half. And I actually thought I was done with the novel. And I came downstairs and I, you know, read it to my wife. And then she said, you can't end the book on that, you know, no one's going to know what happened to Sam, because basically the end of the chapter, you know, says that heaven descends upon Sam. And I thought, well, that's the end of the book. And she said, no, you can't do it that way. So I see, she says, you got to write something else. You got to let people know that Sam and his family, everyone is okay.
Yeah, that's important.
And so I said, okay, right. Great, that's a great idea. So I just went upstairs, and in 45 minutes, I rewrote the epilogue. You know, in part based on the inspiration of this dream of Walt Whitman and I walking through the woods together. And so it was very, very easy to sort of pick up on that theme. And I was able to write the epilogue very easily. And then I knew that I was done. All right. Well, good. Well, thank you both so much. I really appreciate your time and allowing me this platform to discuss this book.
This has really been fun.
It's been
okay,
a pleasure,
great.
Steve.
Well, thanks. All right. Have a very happy Christmas and good new year, and I look forward to hearing from you.
Very good. Jay Gurudev.
Jay Gurudev.
Jay Gurudev.